NPR News, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Mitt Romney has picked up an endorsement from Congressman Paul Ryan for the GOP's presidential nomination. Ryan, who chairs the House Budget Committee, announced his decision in an interview that aired on Fox News this morning.
I am convinced that Mitt Romney has the skills, the tenacity, the principles, the courage, and the integrity to do what it takes to get America back on track.
The congressman says he believes that dragging out the race through the summer will make it more difficult for Republicans to defeat President Obama. Firefighters are bracing for a windy weekend of battling flames in Colorado's Jefferson County. Hundreds are on the scene racing to contain a wildfire that began as a control burn before it got out of hand and seared 6 square miles of rugged terrain. It has burned through dozens of homes and killed at least 2 people. A third person is still missing. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.
Illinois Public Media's spring fundraising drive starts in a few weeks, and we want to keep the drive short and our member support strong. So for every $25,000 we raise before April 13th, we'll deduct a full day from the drive. It's our way of thanking you for helping us reach the April goal of raising $250,000 in membership support. Please do your part to shorten this drive by contributing online right now at willpledge.org. Thanks so much.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Docha, presenting the 2012 Docha Festival, featuring chamber music events and young people's concerts March 30th through April 3rd at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Champaign. A complete list of festival performances is at docha.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we move into hour number two of the show. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for not only this hour, he was on for hour number one. Well, while we like to think that most of the choices that we make as we move through life are the product of careful decision-making, the fact of the matter is that they're not. Much of what we do is a matter of habit. And it's also true that, as we know, that habits can be harmless, they can also be hazardous. They're very hard to change. Hard, but not impossible. In this part of Focus, we have as our guest Charles Duhigg. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. And we will be talking about what you will find in his recent book, The Power of Habit. The subtitle is Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Random House is the publisher. The book tries to explain how habits are formed and makes the argument that understanding how habits work can help us lose bad habits and perhaps acquire positive ones. Our guest is winner of the National Academies of Sciences, National Journalism, and George Polk Awards. He was part of a team of finalists for the Pulitzer Prize in 2009. He's frequent contributor to This American Life, NPR, PBS NewsHour, and Frontline. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And again, as we talk, as always on the show, questions are welcome. People want to call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, so if it's a long distance call, use that, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And Mr. Duhigg, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Hey, well, thanks very much for talking with us. I think this is a really fascinating, and I think that it gets at this the reality that as we go through life, I think we think we're doing one thing, but we're really doing something else. And I think that gets to this issue of how much of what we do really is habit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In fact, there was a study that was done by a researcher from Duke University a couple of years ago where she followed people around all day and sort of took notes on every single decision that they made or action that they took. And what she found was that about 40 to 45% of our daily behaviors are actually habits. They might feel like they're decisions, but they're not. They're these sort of automatic routines that unfold in our life.
And does that mean that is it possible that you could be conscious of the fact that what you're doing is a habit, that you habitually do something in a particular way, and you know that, or at some level, is this something that is unconscious and we truly don't know that we are doing that?
Well, it's So to answer that, let me sort of explain how a habit works. Uh-huh. What we've discovered in the last decade, and this largely comes from research that's done in neurology laboratories, is that every habit has three components. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for the behavior to start unfolding almost automatically. And then there's a routine, which is the behavior itself. And then finally, a reward. And the reward is how your brain decides to remember a pattern for future use. Now, when most people think about habits, they focus in on the routine, the behavior. But what we've learned is that the cue and the reward are really the secrets for analyzing habits and changing habits and creating new habits. And the reason why is because cues and rewards, they actually move the cognition about behind a habit from the prefrontal cortex, which is where sort of decision-making occurs, to a part of the brain known as the basal ganglia, which is near the center of our skull and is one of the oldest neurological structures. The basal ganglia essentially does things that feel automatic. When you walk or when you have an emotional reaction, that's the basal ganglia that's acting up. And so that's why it feels like a habit is this automatic, almost unthinking reaction. You are thinking, but you're thinking with a part of your brain that's fairly far away from where decisions are made.
Hmm. So again, that's as you said, and we can talk about this some more, though, that's maybe why it is sometimes, if one has a habit that you're trying to break or a behavior that you're trying to change, you're not concentrating on the right stuff. You're not concentrating on the cue and the reward. You're concentrating on the thing itself. And if you're just saying to yourself, well, if I could just stop doing this thing, then that's where I want to go. And that's really not where you need to intervene in the loop to actually have change occur.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Maybe it would help to give some kind of concrete example of a loop for a particular behavior and how that
sure,
works.
Sure, absolutely. In fact, I can sort of use my own personal experience as an example. You know, when I started reporting this book, I had this bad habit of going up and eating a cookie every afternoon in the cafeteria at the New York Times where I work. And so when I was talking to psychologists, one of the things I would ask them is, how do I change this habit? And what they said is you need to diagnose the cue and the reward. And so I started by looking at the cue. Almost all cues fall into one of five categories. It's usually either a time of day, a particular place, the presence of certain other people, a particular emotion, or a preceding set of actions that have become ritualized. And so I wrote down those five things every single time the cookie urge struck. And what I figured out pretty quickly was that it always hit between 3:15 and 3:45. It was a time of day that was triggering, that was the cue for my habit. And then I needed to figure out the reward. And so I was talking to, you know, I thought that the reward was a cookie because I like eating cookies. But when I was talking to researchers, what they explained to me is rewards are really complicated. So take a cookie, for example. Is it that a cookie satisfies a craving for hunger? In which case, an apple should probably work just as well. Or that I've come to crave the rush that comes from sugar and kind of, you know, the chocolate, in which case a coffee should do the job, or I want that sweet taste, in which case Splenda should work just as well, or I want a break from work, in which case getting up and taking a walk around the block should do the trick. And so I ran little experiments to try and figure out what exactly is the reward that this habit is providing. What I figured out is that when I went up to the cafeteria, that's when I had a chance to see my colleagues from work and kind of gossip about what was going on. It was socialization that I was craving, and the cookie was just an excuse for it. And so once I had figured out the cue, a certain time of day, and the reward, which is this urge for socialization, I was able to reconstruct this habit. And so now every day at about 3:30, I stand up and I look around and I find someone to go gossip with, and I go over to their desk and I gossip for 10 minutes, and then I come back to my desk, and the urge for a cookie has completely disappeared.
Huh. And I understand you've lost some weight, too.
Yeah, I've actually, between that and other, it's creating exercise habits and eating, you know, changing my eating habits, I've lost about 30 pounds since I started writing the book.
Our guest is Charles Duhigg. He's a reporter for The New York Times, and his new book is The Power of Habit, and it is published by Random House, and it is about habits and what they are, how they work, and also maybe provide some insight into this process. So it's not necessarily a self-help book, but it is the kind of book that perhaps by understanding this process a little bit better, it might help you if there's a habit you're trying to change. Maybe there's a bad habit you'd like to shed, or that there is a positive habit that you would like to acquire. It might help you think about ways to strategies to do that. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Now, having said all that, I'm sure that people will also introduce the wrinkle that there are some habits that involve things that are physiologically addictive and that complicate matters. And you know, just for example, talk about smoking, where there are all sorts of related behaviors. There's times that people associate smoking with certain other things, which that's one of the things that complicates the business of quitting. But then, as far as the body is concerned, part of the reward is nicotine. And, you know, you develop a dependence on that. And there may be some other kinds of behaviors that are similar that would seem to me to be a little bit more resistant to change because they have that component as part of them.
Well, so smoking's a really interesting example, right? Because I think people think about smoking as this physically addictive. Nicotine is physically addictive.
Right.
But what's interesting is that nicotine is actually only biochemically addictive for about 100 hours after your last cigarette. Once the nicotine is out of your bloodstream, you're no longer physically addicted to cigarettes. And yet, we all know people who 2 weeks or 2 months or even 2 years after giving up cigarettes, they'll sit down with their morning paper and they have this urge to have a smoke. That's the habit that's reemerging, not the physical addiction. And yet, to someone who is a former smoker, the habit and the physical addiction feel the same within their brain, right? This is the strength and power of habits, is that they're so compelling that it feels indistinguishable from a physical addiction. And in fact, smoking is a great example of kind of how to analyze these cues and rewards, because one of the things we know is that when people, years after giving up cigarettes or months after giving up cigarettes, have an urge to smoke, it's often because they're around the cues that used to trigger their smoking, like sitting down with the morning paper. And it's because they're craving the rewards that cigarettes used to provide to them. You know, nicotine, the reason why people smoke it is because it makes you feel pretty good, right? It gives you this burst of energy. And so in order to kick that habit, what you really have to do is you have to find something else that delivers the same reward. Studies have shown that if people start drinking, you know, a double espresso in the morning with their paper, that it helps them overcome this urge to have a cigarette because it delivers a similar type of reward, this stimulation that nicotine used to provide.
So that's really very interesting, because then what that says is that there's really not a whole lot of difference in how this works between the cigarette and your chocolate chip cookie.
That's exactly right. Now that being said, obviously some habits are harder than others, right? And cigarettes being one of them, because the reward that's provided by that stimulation of nicotine is a much more intense reward than is provided by a chocolate chip cookie. But we know that there are people who seem to have sort of very little control over their eating habits. And I think for them, what they would say is, listen, the urge to have French fries feels as strong as the urge that other people feel to smoke. And there seems to be a lot of neurological evidence that that's not untrue.
So was there something particular that got you interested in this subject to the point where you committed to do a lot of research and thinking about it and ultimately ended up writing the book?
Yeah, you know, I had sort of come to this topic almost a decade ago. I was a reporter in Iraq, and I had heard about this army major that was conducting kind of an experiment in a city named Kufa, which was a few hours about an hour to the south of Baghdad. And so I went down and talked to this guy, and his job was to stop riots from happening in Kufa. And he had come into town, and he had met with the town's mayor, and he asked him, and a laundry list of things, but one of them was, can you take all of the food sellers out of the plazas? So the town's mayor, who was dealing with things like, you know, suicide bombers and stuff like that, said, sure, then no problem. I'll go ahead and do that. I can take the kebab sellers out of the town, out of the plazas. So a couple of weeks later, there's a crowd starts developing in one of the plazas, and the local cops radio and say, look, we need you guys to be on standby because it looks like a riot's about to happen. And the thing about riots is that they take a long time to develop. It's the type of thing where, you know, hours and hours go by. So the crowd starts building up, and hours go by, and it gets to about 5:30, and everyone starts getting hungry. And the spectators start looking around for these kebab sellers they're used to buying dinner from. But, of course, none of them are there because they were all taken out. And so they go home. And then another group of, you know, everyone else who is sort of waiting around sees the spectators leaving, and they decide to go home too. And eventually everyone goes home and there's no riot. And there hadn't been a riot in 9 months since this guy had arrived. And I thought that this was just kind of fascinating. And I asked the major how he knew that this would happen. And what he said was that essentially what he had learned in the military is that you can look at all behavior in terms of habits, that the military is this giant machine for changing habits. And that once you start looking at the world in terms of habits, you realize that there's all these patterns you can influence, like the patterns of how a crowd behaves before a riot breaks out.
Hmm. That's very interesting. Well, we talked a little bit, at least just gave a couple of examples about how habits work, how habits are formed, and if there's a habit that you want to change, how it's possible to intervene if you know where to intervene in the process, and that often what's happening is that people are not intervening in the right place. So
that's right.
You know, having said all that, say you have something, a positive behavior, which you would like to make a routine part of your life. So essentially, you would like to make it a habit. Say, you know, and I'm sure that some people would say, oh, I really need to exercise. You know, I need to make a regular habit of exercising, but I just can't seem to figure out how to get that into my life and how to do it. So can you take what we know here about habits and how they work to actually cultivate a habit, something that you want to have?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean that happens all the time. In fact, one of the places where we see a lot of research done around this is involving exercise, mm-hmm. Because a lot of people want to create exercise habits. And so what we know about creating exercise habits is that, first of all, you have to choose an obvious cue. You need to work out at the same time every day, or you need to put on your running shoes before breakfast. You need to give your brain things that can latch onto as consistent cues for the exercise habit to start building. But then on the other end of it, you also need to give yourself a reward. And one of the things that studies have found is that the best way of creating an exercise habit is to give yourself a small piece of chocolate after you work out, which, of course, is counterintuitive to most people, because the whole reason that they're working out is to try and lose weight. Mm. But what we know is that your brain at first, even though intellectually you might know that you enjoy exercise, that it's going to make you feel good, your brain basically doesn't believe you. Your brain has not learned to associate working out with a positive reward. And so in order to jumpstart that process, you need to kind of trick your brain by giving it a real reward that it genuinely enjoys after you exercise. Now, 2 or 3 weeks later, you won't need that chocolate anymore. In fact, you won't even want that chocolate anymore, because your brain will have learned that there's endorphins and endocannabinoids, neurotransmitters that are released when you exercise. But at least for the first couple of weeks, you have to have a reward that you genuinely enjoy, and that reward will start this habit forming.
Oh, that's very interesting. I'm sure that people, if they're trying to set up a reward for themselves, maybe they're trying to be really rational about it, and they're going to say, "Well, you know, my reward is good health. It's feeling better. It's longer life. It's you know, whatever." And perhaps people are also thinking about losing weight, so they say, "Well, I'm going to look better." But all of that's kind of abstract, and it's pretty long term. It's not going to, at the end of an exercise session, the world is not going to change.
That's exactly right.
Well, this is giving yourself at least a little something, right? It's immediate reward, and that it's immediate reinforcement.
Well, and the other part of that is that a reward has to be something that you genuinely enjoy. So I think the other mistake that people often make is they say, "Well, okay, I'm going to go exercise, and my reward is going to be that I'm going to have some kale chips and spinach." But the problem is, no one actually likes kale chips and spinach, right? Not as much as you like chocolate. A reward has to be genuinely rewarding. You can't talk yourself into enjoying a reward. It has to be something that your brain genuinely likes on its own. And that's why the habit starts forming.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Charles Duhigg. He is a reporter for The New York Times and has written this book that's all about habit. That's the title. The title is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Random House is the publisher on the book, and it's got a lot of interesting things there about why it is that we behave in the ways that we do and how much of it really is about habit and how habits are formed and how habits can be changed. So questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, good any way that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. And there's email to will-talk at illinois.edu. So another part of this that I think it's really interesting is that people who want to sell us stuff understand this perfectly well, and it is something that they take, that they try to take advantage of. If, you know, what if ultimately they're interested in stimulating us to buy things and to have brand loyalty, they've also looked very closely at how this thing works.
That's exactly right. In the New York Times Magazine, we ran an excerpt where we were talking about Target, because Target has a huge department focused on studying consumer habits. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to do two things. First of all, figure out what is going on within someone's life by studying what they habitually buy. One of the examples that we use is that Target is very interested in identifying when female customers are pregnant, even if that customer hasn't told Target that they're pregnant. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because Target knows that when you're pregnant, a lot of your habits are up for grabs, right? People who are about to give birth or have a brand new baby at home, they're exhausted. What they want to do, they don't want to go to five or six different stores to buy groceries and cleaning supplies and clothes. They want to buy everything in one place. And Target sells all of that stuff, so they want to be that one place that everyone comes into. But to convince women and new fathers to come in and buy in Target, they have to know who's pregnant. And what they found is that they can predict who's pregnant by looking at their shopping habits and looking for these small little habits that emerge when you're pregnant. Like, for instance, they found that a number of pregnant women during the beginning of their second trimester would stop buying scented lotion and start buying unscented lotion. And then a couple of weeks later, they would, on average, often start buying zinc and magnesium and other vitamins that are associated with prenatal care. And then a couple of months after that, at the beginning of the third trimester, they would start buying a huge number of cotton balls and washcloths. And so once they found these patterns, these shopping habits that are associated with pregnancy, they could start looking through all of their consumers to see if this was happening. And when it was, say, this customer must be pregnant. Let's start sending her coupons for diapers and for formula.
And that's, of course, that's dependent on now these systems we have for tracking people and everything that they buy and keeping those records, so that then you have this enormous database. You have all your customers. You know what they've been buying. You have seen these patterns over and over again, so that gets you to the point where you can say, aha. Earlier on, this is what this person is doing, and we know because we've seen it over and over again what that means, so that then you can presumably that person knows that they're pregnant. Maybe not everybody in that family knows that they're pregnant, but that you can then target that person, and then that's why early on you can start sending that person come-ons or coupons or whatever it is for stuff you know that they're going to need later.
That's exactly right.
We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that here where we are in Urbana, and that is line number one. Hello. Is there a caller there on line one in Urbana? Well, perhaps not. Perhaps that person changed their mind. They can call. Anybody can call if you have questions for us. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And also we got that email, wilf-talk at illinois.edu. Maybe you could just, I'm interested in, are there more particularly appealing examples that have to do with marketing and that bring in this habit loop and demonstrate how people who are wanting to sell us stuff understand this very well?
Yeah, one of the stories that we tell in the book is about the story of Febreze. So Febreze is a fairly well-known product that it's a kind of amazing spray that you can spray onto fabrics, and it makes all the smells within a fabric disappear. And so when Febreze first came out, Procter & Gamble, the company that invented it, thought that it was going to be a huge hit. Because consumers had been telling them for years that they were They were tired of coming home from a smoky bar and having to put their jacket outside so that it didn't smell like smoke anymore, or that they had a dog and they loved their dog, but they hated how the dog made the couch smell. So Procter & Gamble bottles up Febreze. They spend millions of dollars getting the product ready, and they figure, we'll go sell this to people who have bad smells in their life. This will transform everything. And they go out into a couple of test markets, and they show some advertisements that show people in smoky bars and people with dogs. And it's a total flop. Nobody buys Febreze. And the reason why is when they realize is when they start doing experiments, they start doing interviews, they realize that people who have bad smells in their lives. Well, for instance, they went to this one woman's house who owned a number of cats. And in fact, she owned so many cats that when the researchers walked into her living room, the smell of overcats was so overpowering that one of them started gagging. So they're talking to this woman who they had given samples of Febreze to, and they say to her, you know, tell us how you use Febreze. And she says, well, I don't actually use it that much. And one of them says, well, what about the cat smell? Do you use it for the cat smell? And she says, you know, sometimes I use it for the cat smell. And the guy who had actually started gagging says, well, what about right now? You know, would you use it, for instance, right now? And she said, well, no, you know, actually I have the best cats. They're not that smelly, so I don't really have to use it. What they realized is that people who have bad smells in their life, they don't recognize those smells. They become immune to those smells, right? People who smoke, actually, their olfactory senses get so damaged by smoking that they can't smell the cigarette smoke anymore. And that was the problem, was that the cue that they had figured would sell Febreze, this bad scent, no, the people who had bad smells in their life, they couldn't actually detect that cue anymore. So what they did is they went back to their corporate laboratories, and they watched a whole bunch of videotapes that they had collected of how people clean their homes. And what they had found was that there are habits inherent in cleaning that they could take advantage of. In fact, they would watch some videotapes and a woman, for instance, would make her bed and then smile kind of at her bed after she had made it. In another videotape, they were watching someone vacuum the floor, and the person, after vacuuming, looked at the freshly vacuumed floor and kind of sighed contentedly. And they realized that they could, instead of making Febreze something that you use to clean bad smells, you could make it something that had its own scent, something that smelled good, like a little smell celebration at the end of a cleaning ritual. So they added a whole bunch of perfume to Febreze, and they put it back out on the market. And that's exactly what sold it, was that people started using it at the end of their cleaning rituals, at the end of their cleaning habits, and Febreze became a habit itself.
Oh. Again, that's really fascinating, and it's not so much, one would think maybe at some level that people were in denial about their house smelling bad. Well, that wasn't it at all. It was just that it didn't smell bad to them. So then you had to figure, well, okay, what's the proper reward? It's not getting rid of the bad smell. The reward in this case would be introducing a nice smell, and that those are actually two different things.
Right. Hey, listen, I apologize. I'm a reporter at the New York Times, and I just got... My editors are waving at me. We apparently have some breaking news that is exploding right now that I think I have to go help.
I see. Well, that's interesting. I guess we have to let you go.
Yeah, I totally apologize.
Listen, believe me, I understand. You're a working reporter, and when the boss calls and says, this is a story and we have something for you to do, then you got to go.
The whole newsroom is going crazy. So apparently.
Oh, well, maybe I better go on to the website of the New York Times and find out what's going on. Well, I'll say to people listening, it's a very interesting book. You should check it out. It's The Power of Habit by our guest, Charles Duhigg. He is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Hey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on. Take care.